You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you listening today because we're coming back to some of the troubling things we heard from Dr. Michael Osterholm last Thursday. Dr. Osterholm is deeply concerned about the spread of the B.1.1.7 variant in the United States. You might have heard him compare it to a Category 5 hurricane gathering offshore, but undeniably headed for land. And as Dr. Osterholm studies the data and observes how this variant has behaved in other countries, he told us about the example of Manaus, Brazil.
They had a serious outbreak of COVID in the late spring and early summer, such that it was such a house on fire that they estimated by the time that outbreak started to subside that over 75% of the residents of Manaus had been infected. Well, then P1, one of the variants we've been talking about that actually evades immunity, took off in Manaus. And through December and up till now, they're in worse shape now than they were last summer.
Indeed, Dr. Osterholm believes we're headed for more spikes in cases, hospitalizations, and higher mortality, and what he calls the darkest days of the pandemic. We thought it'd be valuable to hear how other infectious disease scientists are reading the signs for the next 60 days. Are they more optimistic? How should Americans who are weary from the illnesses and the restrictions and the solitude prepare for another wave if indeed it's headed our way? Two guests and your questions. What do you want to know about how the variants are behaving and what they'll mean for the next 60 days? And do you feel prepared if it's necessary to go back to a more restricted way of life? So questions about the variants, what scientists are observing about the way they're behaving and spreading and what that may mean for the next 60 days, and whether we all feel prepared if it ends up being necessary to go back to even more restrictions. Things are easing up now. What if we had to do that? How would you manage that? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can also reach me on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Dr. James Hamblin is with us, a physician, a lecturer at Yale School of Public Health, co-host of the podcast Social Distance. And he joins us this morning from Brooklyn. Dr. Hamblin, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Professor Ellie Murray is with us, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at Boston University School of Public Health and co-host of the podcast Casual Inference, and with us from Boston. And Professor Murray, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Hamblin, your piece in The Atlantic last week is notably more optimistic than Dr. Osterholm's, with some caveats in place. And we're going to talk about that. But I want to read a graph from the piece about what you think is ahead for the summer. Much of the country could soon have reason to lift many or even most restrictions on distancing, gathering, and masking. Pre-pandemic norms could return to schools, churches, and restaurants. Sports, theater, and cultural events could resume. People could travel and dance indoors and hug grandparents, their own or others. In most of the U.S., the summer could feel normal. Now, introduce the reality of what's happening with these variants or not happening. And how does that portrait change, if at all?
Right. So, yeah, that is the optimistic portion of that story. And it gets significantly more complicated later on. But based on the trends that we're seeing right now, with high-risk populations being vaccinated, vaccination ramping up very quickly, we're seeing our death rates fall much more quickly than, you know, transmission rates even, and transmission is also down, case counts are down. So that's a projection of if that continues, and based on the fact that, you know, local guidance tends to be driven by the case counts in a particular area, you could see things opening. That's definitely good or safe is another question, but on this trajectory, things are getting a lot better really quickly. That could become complicated by the variants. And yeah, there's a lot of potential there for things to see a spike in transmission in cases, but we are not seeing that the variants are evading the vaccines to a degree that, you know, vaccinated people are not dying. So that means the death rate should continue to fall.
So right at the end there, you said something like, yes, you'll see things opening and people behaving more normally. Whether that's a good thing, we can't say. I mean, are you saying there's going to be a lot of social pressure on reopening if we continue to see case counts drop? You're not sure that that's really where we ought to be headed?
You know, this virus, I think the main lesson of it is it should be humility. It's extremely difficult to forecast. I can say that it will be almost impossible politically, socially, for any leaders to tell people that when case counts have dropped really far and they're down and the high-risk populations are vaccinated, it's going to be really hard to convince anyone that you need to keep restaurants closed or schools closed, even if you know, there are warnings from people like Dr. Osterholm about the potential for variants causing another surge. And I think we want to, you know, have a close eye out for that. But the reality is that's not going to happen if the numbers are extremely low.
Right. Professor Murray, listen to a bit more of what Dr. Osterholm is really concerned about when it comes to transmission patterns.
What we're following right now is almost a similar scenario as we saw in the European countries that have been so hard hit by this virus in terms of, you know, weeks of early transmission where the level appears to be low, but then it picks up very quickly. And if you think about doubling numbers, you know, 2 to 4 to 8 to 16 doesn't mean big changes. But if you start doubling 2,000 to 4,000 to 8,000 to 16,000, those are big numbers. And that's what we're worried about. This virus is following that same path in North America as we have seen in Europe and the Middle East.
Professor Murray, what do you see in, given what he's saying about doubling and the paths of transmission and the history in other countries?
Yeah, so I think that the variants are definitely something we need to be concerned about as a potential for increasing into a fourth wave, you know, even as we're coming out of the third wave here. I think, you know, what most public health people have been recommending is to not open back up too soon, to make sure that we can control transmission. You know, the levels that we were seeing in the winter really, though, you know, that was really dangerous because, you know, it favors the more transmission there is, the more development of newer variants that there might be, the easier it is for new variants to spread without us really noticing them because we don't do a whole lot of genomic testing in the U.S. And so, you know, what we're seeing now is that we're at levels that, you know, they're way down from where they were around, you know, Christmas and New Year's, but we're still at levels that are would have been considered really high for the summer. And seeing places open up with this possibility of the new variants increasing in the future, that's really concerning.
That's such a great point, because we are still seeing counts of deaths somewhere between 800 and, 1,200 on a given day, people dying. I mean, imagine if we heard those numbers last February. People would be shocked, but they just look better because they're in comparison, right?
Right, exactly. So I think, you know, people are starting to breathe this sigh of relief from the winter. And I think that that's, you know, kind of exactly the wrong thing to do. We need to double down to get those counts down to, you know, what they were at the end of the summer, what they were at the end of May, and below that, so that we can really be safer in opening up things, you know, towards the end of the spring and the summer, and also so that we can keep a better eye on what's happening with the variants.
All right, let's take some calls here. If you've just gotten in on the show, Professor Ellie Murray is with us, an assistant professor of epidemiology at Boston University School of Public Health, and Dr. James Hamblin is with us, a doctor and a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he wrote a piece that presents one view of a more optimistic summer. But we're talking about how these variants and warnings from trusted voices like Dr. Michael Osterholm, where they fit in, given the way the variants are spreading, given some of the unknowns about what's going to happen in the next 30 days. You know where Dr. Osterholm is on this. Very concerned about some dark days ahead in the next 60 or more days. Hearing some other more optimistic, but, you know, careful warnings about what may be ahead from other infectious disease experts. And I'm asking you this morning about how you hear these warnings, what your questions are about the way the variants are spreading, and what if we did have to go back? I mean, a lot of people are doing some things that feel pretty normal. What if we had to go back to a more restricted way of being and living? 651-227-6000 to Christian in Brooklyn Center. Hey, Christian, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What do you want to know?
So I'm a parent of two elementary school students that we've kept at home for the first two trimesters of their school. And we were thinking about sending them back for third trimester. But with these variants, our question is always, how is it impacting schools and children in general, since most of the infections in children aren't seen because they don't really show signs? And there's all this talk that schools aren't a transmission point, but I wanted to know what the variants could impact that.
Yeah, Dr. Hamlin, I just heard on Morning Edition this morning research that came out of a school system that seems to point to educators spreading the disease among themselves and not really kids. What do you make of this question?
You know, schools have been, for the past year, the one area where I just really want to tread extremely lightly, and I still feel that way. I think they should be a priority, but they're such focal points for so much of the way our society and economies work, and there's so many effects of keeping them closed. My hope is that, you know, teachers are a priority and are able to get vaccinated, and that schools can open safely after teachers and staff are vaccinated. And that should happen, if it hasn't already, very, very shortly. And I think, you know, that should just be a top priority right now.
So Dr. Hamlin, it sounds like you do not concur with where the CDC and the Biden administration are on opening elementary schools even before teachers are vaccinated. I mean, they're saying the research shows that if the social distancing is happening and the masking among the teachers as well, of course, they're not gathering in places in the school, that you can really control for outbreaks. It sounds like you say wait until the teachers are vaccinated to open up in-person learning. Is that right?
That's,
I know this is tough, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it is. But it's almost a false choice because we are rolling out vaccines so quickly. It should be, you know, within a matter of weeks, we should be able to have all teachers vaccinated. I think that, you know, we almost every state could probably do a better job prioritizing that, because schools are such a focal point of the way our societies work. And if there are still teachers that haven't been vaccinated, it's just hard to justify too many other professions ahead of that.
Yeah. Professor Murray, do you have a view on teachers? I can't tell you how many conversations we've had about this, and I know parents are confused about it. Where do you come in?
Yeah, so I mean, I definitely sympathize with parents who have kids at home and are really concerned about, you know, what's happening with their education and just having those kids bored and things like that. But I agree that, you know, really, I would like to see teachers vaccinated before schools open. And then I think in terms of our conversation about the variants here, I think it's really important to note that the evidence suggests that in the UK, where the variants really circulated throughout the fall in the elementary, you know, K-12 school system there. And that's sort of where they took off from. And I think we're not doing at all enough testing of school children. A lot of people will report that they can't get their kids tested even when their kids are sick. And so this is really clouding what we're seeing with schools. And, you know, certainly schools should be a priority in a perfect world. But I think we're seeing a lot of places that, you know, restaurants and things are being prioritized over schools. And we're seeing a lot of schools where things like social distancing and masking and ventilation are not possible. You know, either the school's too crowded or the building's too old or the windows don't open and things like that. And so I think realistically, you know, even if it's not absolutely necessary that teachers get vaccinated before schools open, realistically, I think we do need teachers vaccinated before opening up the schools.
Okay. Call here from Roxanne in International Falls. Hi, Roxanne. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering if soon with the variants, we're going to end up being told we're not fully vaccinated until a third booster for some of the variants is developed and given. I own a group home. And I also want to know if we're fully vaccinated at this point. Can people feel comfortable being just together with people who are fully vaccinated and take their masks off?
Right. Good questions for the business and the people that are at your congregate care center there. Professor Murray, can you feel fully vaccinated if you've had the Pfizer, Moderna, and now the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that's coming online, given what the variants are doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously no vaccine is 100% perfectly effective, but, you know, the vaccines that we have developed have exceeded our hope for, you know, what this time last year we were hoping for a vaccine. So they are great vaccines. I think, you know, people can feel pretty confident once they've gotten them. The evidence seems to be that they work still quite well, against all of the variants. And so if you have, you know, two or three people who've all received all their doses of the vaccines and given, a week or two for their bodies to respond to that, those people can probably be safe enough to, you know, stop masking and things in company with each other. And part of this is because, you know, even if the vaccines don't perfectly, you know, protect against infection, they do seem to really all work very well against severe illness and death. So if you are in company with other people who've been vaccinated, you can maybe let down your guard. But then really important that if you then go and see someone who's not been vaccinated, to make sure that you're taking all those precautions again around those other people. So still wearing your mask when you're with people who haven't been vaccinated, just because there is a possibility you might have a very mild infection and could transmit it to those people.
That's such good news, though. I mean, you want to hear that if you've had the vaccine, you've had both shots, you don't have to still live in this super restricted way if you are with other people who have had a vaccination. Some of the messaging on this, Professor Murray, has been confusing to, sure, get the vaccine, but then live exactly the same way you've been living. And I think that's, you know, that causes some despair, too, in people who think I can finally see the light here. So good to hear you say that.
Yeah, I think that messaging is partly because, you know, there's sort of the two aspects of the vaccine. How well is it going to protect you personally against having severe disease? And how well is it going to protect those people around you? And the trials were really focused on that first question. How well does it prevent an individual from getting really sick or dying? And we know that it does a great job at that. But we're only just starting to see the studies come out on how well it protects those people around you. So, there was a lot of concern that we didn't want everyone to completely let down their guards.
Right.
We didn't want them to take off their masks in public and things like that, while we didn't have a huge number of people vaccinated. But it is seeming now more and more like we can say, okay, yes, you are protected from getting sick. Other people who are vaccinated are protected getting sick. Definitely with them, you can feel comfortable, but then still continue to take precautions around the general public just because our vaccination rates are still quite low, even though we are doing a great job at getting vaccinations rolled out. It takes time.
Yeah, I want to play something here from Dr. Ajit Jha that I was listening to a podcast, and he was taking note of what Dr. Osterholm had said about dark days ahead, and also looking at the data and looking at the vaccination rates. Here he is in conversation with Bill Kristol on Kristol's podcast.
So Mike Osterholm, very smart guy, he thinks that the next couple of months are going to be the worst of the pandemic. And I am hesitant to contradict Mike Osterholm because he's so smart and so good. And I think he's wrong. I think he's being too pessimistic because we can see the variant coming. We're going to be doing really good genomic sequencing. And we've got a lot of vaccines out there. And we've got a good amount of population immunity from people having been previously infected. If the variant had arrived 3 months ago, I would have agreed with him. It's arriving at a time where I think we're going to be more ready.
So, Dr. Hamlin, I want to ask you about the rate of vaccination. When I look at the percentages in states, you know, you look at a big map, you see Minnesota is like at 8-point-something% of vaccinations. I mean, there are, I don't think, any states that are well into double digits on vaccination. So are we really at a level, enough of a protective level here with vaccines to fend off whatever these variants are going to bring?
I'm optimistic about it because of the way the vaccines are being distributed. I mean, I think there's still a lot of room to grow there, but this is not an equal opportunity disease. You know, it affects people with chronic conditions and the elderly vastly more intensely than young, healthy people. And by getting those populations vaccinated and ideally vaccinating people who are sit at the crux of distribution, you know, people who have to come into contact with a lot of other people, that effective number of something like 8% is really has a much bigger impact. It's misleadingly small in terms of what we can expect the effects of that to be. And then you also have to consider state to state and even city to city, there is a lot of difference in the level of natural immunity that's out there in terms of people who've had the disease and recovered or been exposed and recovered. That's a very thorny issue, but we do see in some of the hardest hit states like North Dakota, things have been able to start opening up and as vaccination is rolling out, and they've had almost no deaths in recent days. And so it seems that there is a large effect of the immunity people have developed from just being exposed to the virus, which is, you know, a catastrophic outcome that no one wanted. But it does mean that, say, an 8% vaccination rate in a place that's already been really hard hit will look different than in a place like Vermont, where there's something like 2% of the population has already been infected.
That's a really good point. Yeah, because, I mean, we know we're very aware here in Minnesota, we were kind of surrounded by states that took different paths on masking and social distancing and, you know, leaders, state leaders giving guidance on this. So you look at a state like North Dakota and you will see more, I think you're saying, more overall protection because of the number of people who have had it and now the number of people who are being vaccinated. And we should understand as we look. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, can I clarify on that?
Please
because,
do.
You know, to you mentioned earlier the case of Manaus, Brazil, which deserves a lot of global attention because that seemed to be a place where there was about 75% population-wide immunity. The virus had just devastated the city last spring. And then, and so it would have seemed that there was protection and a surge where people were, you know, hospitals ran out of oxygen and people were buried in mass graves. And that they just did not think this was possible. So we don't know a lot about natural immunity. And while we might see the effects in terms of numbers dropping in places like North Dakota, we cannot rely on natural immunity to reliably last and to protect us from these variants. What we can, so we still need to focus intensely on vaccination in terms talking about protection, but it would explain if you do see drops in certain places that are more drastic than others.
I'm really glad you came back to that because I know you wrote about Manaus too in this piece in The Atlantic. Dr. James Hamlin with us, a physician. He wrote a big long piece about this in The Atlantic, also a lecturer at Yale School of Public Health, and Professor Ellie Murray, assistant professor of epidemiology at Boston University's School of Public Health. Conversation this morning about how to read the data, the percentages of vaccinations that are rolling out, the natural immunity from people who have already had COVID, and what is ahead for the next 60 days with these variants. Last Thursday, Dr. Osterholm was on the show reiterating his great concern for what is ahead in the next 60 days because of the variants. I was seeing a number of other infectious disease experts saying, yes, but this may contribute to a more optimistic view. And we're giving you some thoughts on that and a chance to call in with a question about how the variants are behaving and what may lie ahead. Okay, back to the conversation now with Dr. James Hamblin and Professor Ellie Murray, and to the phones to Pamela in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, Pamela. Thanks so much for waiting through the news break. Tell me a little bit about yourself and what you're thinking about.
Hi, I am a labor and delivery nurse here in my city. And my state, as you know, was one that took a different path, as
yes.
you so diplomatically put it, in the terms of the virus. And a couple of weeks ago, I was at work, and one of my colleagues said, do you think we will ever get to stop wearing masks at work? And they didn't just mean this year, within the next couple of years. They meant ever.
Yeah.
And I just have to wonder, and I'm curious what your guests think, because both in my professional and in my personal life, I unfortunately know people and have met people who not only refuse to take the precautions, but are refusing to get vaccinated as well. And do you think that this could be an illness that sticks around to the extent that maybe at large people can go back to quote unquote a normal existence, but certain groups such as healthcare providers will constantly need to take precautions because there will be this subset of the population that will act as a reservoir for this particular infection?
Right. Really good question. Professor Murray, what do you think? Are these standards that healthcare workers are observing now probably in place for a long time to come?
So I think that this is something where it's a little bit hard to predict what's definitely going to happen because it does depend so much on how people behave. But it's certainly within the realm of possibility that COVID could be here kind of as a long-term thing that circulates in the population like the seasonal flu, where we do see some deaths, you know, happening every year going forward. And because of that, healthcare workers may continue to wear masks and take these precautions. We are seeing that the vaccines do seem to work well, and obviously we can't know for sure yet how long the vaccines provide protection, but hopefully once vaccination levels are up to 70-80% of the population, some of those precautions can be relaxed. I think one important thing to remember from the vaccine hesitancy side is that, we're hearing a lot of people say, they're not really comfortable getting the vaccines yet. But sometimes the reason is that it's because it's a new vaccine, or the vaccines are quite new. And so those people may change their minds, 6 months or a year from now, once more people have gotten the vaccine. So I think, we need to try to encourage people to understand the vaccines and to accept them. And not kind of write off, oh, these people are never going to get the vaccine.
Dr. Hamblin, I want to bring up something else that comes out of the story that you wrote for The Atlantic, again, with some pretty optimistic projections for what the summer may look like. But you quote a Yale vaccinologist, Saad Omer. I'm not sure how to pronounce his first name. Maybe you could.
Saad Omer. Yeah.
Okay. He says to you, yes, we could have a pretty good summer. And then he adds, I'm feeling generally optimistic for the U.S. this summer, but I'm also having nightmares. And I wonder if that goes to kind of the reservoir of non-vaccinated people that our caller was talking about.
I think that is the primary concern right now. And you combine that with the possibility of mutations and continued development of variants. If we have a large enough reservoir of people who don't get vaccinated or can't, because much of the world does not have access to the vaccine and is projected not to until very late this year, if not even 2023, if the virus continues to spread, widely, you know, even among vaccinated people, there could be a variant that renders our vaccine significantly less effective and, you know, leaves no one feeling completely free of this. And that's why it's so important to understand that, you know, vaccines are not a personal protective product. They are a tool that functions within a community. That is how they work. If you are vaccinated amid a sea of contagious people, mm-hmm. you should not feel protected. And if you are vaccinated among a sea of vaccinated people, you can do anything you want. And that is the way that these things work. And so hopefully people can have conversations with people they love and they know who trust them, and it can be a long, multiple discussions, dialogues where you hear, you know, what are your hesitancies, what are your concerns, and try, you know, with honesty and empathy to address them, because we just need it. We're going to need to get
many people
close to 100%.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Call here from Aaron in Minneapolis. Hi, Aaron. Good to have you on the phone. Aaron, are you there? We might have missed her. Let's try Krista, and then we'll see if Aaron will get back on the line. Hi, Krista.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I've actually been infected with COVID twice. My first acute phase was pretty bad. My second was not nearly as bad. But after my first, I did have some long haul issues. After my second, they've been worse. Knowing that it doesn't take a severe infection, and the vaccine's really protecting against severe infection and death, that you can get long haul issues. I kind of have questions as to whether, you know, if, like you said, it takes a huge, the whole community to be vaccinated to keep from infection. I'm terrified of a third infection and being even in worse shape. And I also wonder, is the vaccine going to possibly be helping, you know, even if you get, you know, with as we're slowly vaccinating, if someone's infected, is the vaccine protecting in any way? Do they know for long haul? I know that it's such a unknown, but I'm wondering if there are any.
Sure. Boy, that is really concerning, Krista, too, that you had this experience twice. Professor Murray, what would you say?
Yeah, so we are starting to get some information on the vaccines about how well they prevent infection and how well they would prevent, you know, transmission and those sort of lower level infections that you're talking about, mild symptoms. And I think, you know, in the next few weeks, we'll probably see some fairly definitive information coming out with numbers on that. But, you know, it is something that, as I mentioned in the clinical trials, they were really prioritizing those very severe outcomes. And these milder infections that could lead to chronic or longer term illness is something that we're only just really starting to get information on from the trials. I do think it looks like there will be, you know, for certainly there will be some protection against those infection, against milder illness, but we can't say for sure yet what the number is. I also think, you know, this issue of long COVID is something that's really important to be studying more. And I know that there are a lot of groups who are trying to understand, you know, how often that happens, if there's ways we can kind of identify people who might be at risk for those long haul symptoms, so that we can get them the support they need. And this is definitely an active area where researchers are trying to understand, but it's something I think will be more important, certainly as we start to not have to worry quite so much about this, you know, overwhelming number of really severe infections and deaths and the hospitals being overburdened that way. We're going to have to really start grappling with these longer term consequences of COVID, you know, people who may have had COVID, you know, 6 months before now, but still are dealing with symptoms. You know, this is going to be an ongoing thing. It's not like, you know, the vaccine will get out and COVID will be finished. I think right. There's going to be a lot of consequences.
Dr. Hamlin, I just want to, Aaron, who had to drop off, was going to talk to us about working in a restaurant and saying that she feels really exposed. She says none of the patrons are wearing masks. The staff are. What do we know about restaurants and transmission? You know, I think we noted earlier that it seemed surprising that the big push wasn't schools, that, of course, restaurateurs own businesses and they've been suffering too. How do you feel about these restaurants that are back and open and the fact that some of the patrons just aren't going to be wearing masks all the time?
Yeah, I think that means that workers in restaurants should be high priority for vaccination as well. And this is also a great opportunity to improve ventilation, that airflow is key in situations like this in terms of protecting workers, because we know that unless you're wearing an N95, your mask alone when you're talking to a maskless person up close is not ideal. You can't rest assured on that. So these are people who are essentially doing pretty high risk work. If you're coming into contact with a lot of maskless people right now, a lot can be done through ventilation. But it is sad that in many ways they are. There's no way to recreate schools. You have to open them to get the full effect. But we are so close to having these vaccinations available, we have a way to bail out restaurants until all the employees can be vaccinated. We can keep the restaurants alive with a little bit of money for the next few weeks or months. And it could be no one could have to suffer from that.
I hear you saying you don't think the restaurants really ought to be open quite yet.
I understand the predicament, but I would see if these vaccine trials had not worked out and we just had no end in sight, I could see an argument that this is the only way this industry survives. Mm-hmm. But as it is, when you're so close to driving these rates way down and protecting people, especially people who have to work in that environment, that until you can vaccinate that population, it seems it should be very feasible to help make sure those restaurants don't go out of business and just wait a little bit longer.
Here's Jennifer, Professor Murray on Twitter, who says, I thought it was still possible to transmit COVID-19 after vaccination. So if a group of vaccinated friends removes their masks, could they still be spreading it around within the group? Is that wrong? Can you clarify?
Yeah, this is a great question. So, it is likely possible that you can transmit after you've been vaccinated. The vaccine will almost certainly provide some protection against transmission and infection, but we don't know yet how much. So, the upper limit is how well the vaccine protects against disease. The lower limit is sort of no protection. And we're still working out what the actual number is there. But the idea is that since the vaccine does protect well against the disease, in that group of people where everyone's being vaccinated, you may feel comfortable taking off the masks, because even if that group of people gets infected, they are unlikely to get sick or have any severe outcomes. But that said, those people could get potentially infected in that setting. And so that's why we really want to make sure that once you're dealing with people who haven't been vaccinated, including in the general public, that you are taking those, full precautions with other people so that you're not spreading an infection you might have gotten to people who haven't been vaccinated, who would still be at high risk for death or severe COVID.
Yeah, I mean, this could be a situation where you are with your older mother who has gotten the vaccine, you haven't, she's carrying the vaccine but not experiencing the symptoms because she's been vaccinated, but she spreads it to you and then you spread it somewhere else. I mean, that is kind of a path of transmission, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And so, I think, people are really, really anxious to be able to spend some time, especially with those elderly family members.
Right.
Once those family members have gotten vaccinated, I think, if everyone in the room is vaccinated, it is going to be a lot safer to see those people. But yeah, the fact is you could get infected in that setting. And then, so you want to make sure to take the precautions once you're outside that setting to make sure you don't transmit into any other circles, you know, including to other people in your household and people you come in contact with in the grocery store. And, you know, don't go from visiting grandma to indoor dining at a restaurant.
Okay. Yeah, good advice to Ben in Northfield. Hi, Ben.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I'm a consulting epidemiologist to a number of companies here in the U.S. and internationally. And just curious what your guests think about, you know, the effectiveness of some of the policy control measures that have been put in place. You know, we look at Oxford has published, you know, a stringency index of comparing different states here in the U.S. But it seems like when I look at the data, there's loose correlation at best between case rates and stringency. You know, we compare case rates in California to someplace like Florida. So seems to me like much of it comes down to compliance, and just curious, you know, as we think about potentially needing to move into more controls, what that might look like.
Yeah, Professor Murray, let me bring that back to you since you're an epidemiologist as well.
Yeah, so I think, you know, what we're seeing is that it's really difficult to compare between different areas how effective, you know, in order to get a sense of how effective various measures have been, because of the way that they're implemented so differently, you know, even, you know, between different states, what we meant by lockdown in the spring was very different. You know, some states had certain types of buildings, you know, businesses open and others didn't. And across the states, you know, the precautions that we've taken, the restrictions that we've taken have all generally been much lower than in a lot of other countries. And so this does make it pretty challenging to compare between places. I think, you know, it seems like there's pretty good indication that when people do take precautions, we can start to see cases come down. But the precautions people are taking don't necessarily line up exactly with when the regulatory systems are put in place. You know, a lot of times, especially in states that have been reluctant to have things like mask mandates, we see that the mask mandate will finally be put in place at a point when actually most people are already wearing masks. And so, you know, the regulation itself doesn't necessarily do much, even though the masks are helping. And so this just makes it a really big challenge for, you know, understanding what's the best regulation, because as a caller says, really, the key is what people are actually doing and not necessarily what they're being told to do.
Yeah, we had a call earlier. We had Dr. Akshay Rao, who from the U of M, on the line, and we couldn't get to his question before he had to drop. But he was saying to us, look, this is an issue with human behavior. You have to try to help steer people in the right direction, you know, and do a better job of combating vaccine hesitancy or compliance with mask wearing. All comes down to human behavior here. Let me grab one last call here from Angie in Floodwood, Minnesota. Hi, Angie. I'm glad you waited.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Carrie. Yeah, my question kind of springs off that in some of the earlier conversations about restaurant workers. I believe some of the other countries in the world, and I'll point out Israel, are mandating that people have a vaccine record to get into public venues.
Right.
So I'm wondering what your guests are thinking about that going forward in the U.S.
Dr. Hamlin, I've been wondering about this for travel, for gathering, for going to a concert, you know, something like that. What do you think?
Yeah, this is a really difficult issue. I think there will absolutely be some places and things that require this, such as, you know, you're already required to get all kinds of vaccinations to get into school districts, to work in a hospital, et cetera. And I think that there's no question that that will be the case for these vaccines at some point. And possibly also for travel to certain areas, which we already do with things like yellow fever, where people have proof of vaccination. More widely, I don't see that happening. I think there are a lot of issues that would make it difficult to say you
just
can't go into a restaurant or something.
Okay.
Well, because of the way, I think this comes back to the idea of thinking of this as an individual protective measure. policies about opening restaurants, opening schools and whatnot, you know, like we started saying at the beginning, are guided by the burden of disease and cases in an area at a given time. And we just collectively need to drive everything down. We need everyone to get vaccinated. We need to wipe this out and safely reopen restaurants. And we don't need some middling approach where we have some vaccinated class that's able to do some things and another unvaccinated class that is excluded from those things. And it would just be a really potentially introduce a lot of problems, be very difficult to execute, and just would amount to a half measure that we shouldn't have to take.
Yeah, this is something that in our continuing coverage here at 9 a.m. on the pandemic, I know we're going to be talking about. Dr. Hamlin, Professor Murray, our gratitude for being on the show this morning. I really appreciate the nuance and the perspective.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast, and thanks for listening.